This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we have two of my favorite poets today, and they are Beth Doolin and Jenny Keith. Now, they are different voices, but very equally sophisticated in craft, which you will see. And easier to go alphabetically, so here is Beth Doolin with an opening poem.
This is called Components of Loss. In relation to memory, the scent of summer inhaled, inviting the past to pull up a seat. The star-spattered nighttime sky on an old milk farm, a place that no longer exists. A lifetime of running, anonymity begging to fill the hollow shell. The trickery of walking down the street and seeing you in the faces of other men. The betrayal of dreams where you are still alive and living in our Fifth Street apartment. In relation to feeling, a course all its own with no direction, the travel time cannot be estimated. The torture of lost last words rising to my mind's surface. Reluctant hope for the time to come when missing you is just a ghost dream. Being doomed from the start, an ancestry of self-destruction. Expectations from the grave, voices pleading, surely you can do better at surviving than we did. Knowing now that the ground can shift at any given moment. Also knowing now that every moment is given.
That's the voice of Beth Doolin. And I wasn't going to remark after their opening poems, but I have to say that if you saw the page and the long line lengths, you would know that the extended breath is what makes this a lullaby of loss. And I also want to remind everyone, after we remember it, we only remember the feeling. So what Beth has done is put her feelings in such a long lyrical way that we are left with the ache of the poem. And now we're going to hear from Jenny Keith with an opening poem.
This is called An Opening. Of course, my upper lip stayed stiff. The night was dedicated to the artist's work. A flare of color, intrigue, and delight drew butterflies to flit and smoke and smirk. I'd worked more treacherous runes than this, so why I came home with some major organ gone, my world upended, is a mystery. But now, with our post-mortem said and done, I must confess I suffered a small break and stood beside myself. There, I could see the gathering of hours. I was awake and felt the failure of biology. The stars were late. Would any of us stay? I couldn't wait to see and turned away.
Jennifer Keith from her new book. And what is the title of that book?
It's called Terminarch.
I'm not supposed to remark after opening poems so that people will know your voices, but I have to ask you, what does form do for you? Really, you've got it down. Why form?
Form helps contain my biggest feelings.
Nobody ever said it like that.
It's like a cage at the zoo where you can get really, really close to that leopard without it eating your face.
I am so glad I asked. Oh my God. Yeah, just, you know, but here's the thing, that nobody can hide a rhyme like you can, because we don't want it to be a rocking chair. And boy, listen, night, delight, gone, done, awake, stay away, break, awake, stay awake. And we don't even notice because we just think it's embedded in a heartbeat. So I'm really so happy to have you too. Just a word about your book. If someone reads it, then what do they think about your poetry, or what do they know about your poetry?
I would say that I'm trying to make difficult things accessible and give the reader a chance to get close to heavy things without being overwhelmed. Also that I love film and American music, and music is very important to me. So I try to infuse the poems themselves and even the subject matter with a lot of music.
We've got it to give. Tell everyone the title again.
It's called Terminarch, and it came out on Able Muse Press.
And it just came out on the shelf, and you can be one of the first people to get it on Amazon?
Go to Able Muse Press, if you would.
Okay, we'll hear more about that. Uh-huh. Now we're back to know Beth. The best way to know them is through their voices. So, Beth, we're going to hear another poem.
Okay. This just came out, actually. This is called All the Lightning You Carry. The writing on the wall is invisible. Why can't I ever learn? Dandelions sprout from my scalp, but I can't get the words out. I was drowning in fire when I met you, the only escape to burn faster. I raise a glass to all that shatters. Nothing soft exists anymore. You embroidered my name on your leg, stick and poke style, in lavender thread. Still difficult to distinguish from all those accidental injuries. You should be wearing a warning sign. Irresistible danger ahead. I keep getting trapped in open spaces. There's no place to hide. I can barely make out the past up ahead, waiting for me to catch up.
Beth, that title tells us everything that's going to happen. All the lightning you carry, and then it goes off. Then it comes, then a boom, it happens. The poet crosses back and forth across time. And that is what you've got down. And also, for instance, there's no place to hide. I can barely make out the past up ahead, waiting for me to catch up. The poet is the one that uses time magically, because what we're doing now is already gone. Yeah. In psychic terms. So I can tell that you're an artist by the different patterns on your page. Every poet uses different patterns, but I can tell there's something on your page that I know you're visual, and tell me I'm telling the truth about you. Are you an artist?
Yes. I am a visual artist, but it's always been, I started doing that. I'm not trained in, you know, in any kind of visual art, but I started making art in the early 90s when I found myself with like writer's block, you know, and at the time I was going through a lot of really personal trauma and chaos, and my fiction teachers were like, you know, you have to get out of this. You can't write about this now. And so I've spent a lot of time since then writing about that period of time and the past. I write, you know, entirely pretty much about the past.
But I know you have work out, and we'll talk a little bit more about your out. But saying that you're not trained, Beth, none of us is trained in being alive, but yet we manage, we produce, we manage, and you really go from the soul. So while we have you here, let's give us another poem.
Okay. This is another poem about loss. I write a lot about loss.
If we give up loss, what else will we have left?
It's true. And that's, it's something that still is a big thing that I write about. It's something important in my life to process the past. I've lost a lot of people in my life. This is called survivor's guilt. I waded deep into the water and kept on going, knowing I couldn't swim. Eventually, I ran out of bottom. A psychic told me years ago I had drowned in a past life. She said how it happened wasn't the important part, just that I'd been arguing with a man before the boat sank. That's all she could tell me. There's no comfort in narrow escape. I hurl the past against the wall, pick open the infected wound. The wrong things stand out. Silver-tipped fingernail clippings in the ashtray, watermarks on the good furniture, an excessive number of address book entries under the letter G. I read into everything, get good at hiding out behind the curtain, remind myself to remember, I know the formula for every excuse. There's no relief from the tight-throated hollow ache of loneliness. What's unfinished follows everywhere, until I turn and face it.
There you go with your time again. What's unfinished follows everywhere until I turn and face it. There you go, smack up, turning time on its heels and then looking at it. So you're the time poet, and always a surprise ending, always your philosophical underpinning comes at the end. And I'm thinking you discover that as you write the poem.
Yes.
It's not like a game of chess. I mean, I know you don't get there first. I'll tell you who she is. Beth's writing has been in the American Journal of Poetry, Atlanta Review, Gargoyle, Little Patuxent Review, New York Quarterly, South Carolina Review, Whig Leaf, and many others. She's the author of Truce, a limited edition artist book in the collections of the Brooklyn Museum and the Museum of Modern Art. A graduate of the New School, she lives on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, which she left to go to New York, but went back again. Wow. Well, we're going to go now to Jenny. So give us a poem.
Sure. This is a true story. It's called Oracle. When we were girls, we played a game with cards. Four kings, each one standing for a different boy. We shuffled the deck and laid the cards out one by one beneath each king. Who would it be? First date. First kiss that counts. Just friends. The first to match in suit. This was our answer. Screams and giggles, then. The quiet one will be the first. The dark one's love is deep and true. The ginger, hearts, is best in bed. The diamond king will tell a lie and bring me misery in spades. I saw it then, but didn't know the one who'd wear a starry crown, in whom my wound would hold its peace. Here's east and west, here's cute and not, the first to give a ring, the one who turns time with a single word, the prom date, or the lie I tell who haunts the doorway of a dream and aches so like a broken bone, the one who's true, who leads me home. The one my friends don't like, or still, the one whose name I'll say at last when games are over, who will ride, the white, the red, the black, or pale.
If that is not song, I do not know what is song. And also the craft, the perfect tercets, the perfect three lines, so clear, so crisp, and yet no edges on them. I mean, it's a melody, it's a lullaby, no clutter. Tell us about being a musician.
I sort of came at that sort of obliquely. My husband, Chris, is a great drummer and just asked me to fill in with his band one time to just sort of strum to add texture. And I've been obsessed with music since I was a tiny kid. Family lore says I loved Joan Baez's Silver Dagger and that my first non, you know, mama, dada word was dagger. I would stand in my crib and shout dagger because I wanted to hear Joan Baez. So music runs really deep with me and I love playing. I'm not good at it, but I have a great time. So so it's very satisfying.
You're like Beth saying, I wasn't trained. You were trained from something bigger than the earth has. Well, I want to hear another poem, and then we'll decide if you have if you're always singing a song. And I want also people to know that your poems have been in the Nebraska Review, Swanee Theological Review, the Free State Review, Unsplendid, Smartish Pace, Best American Poetry, and also you're a finalist for the Erskine. Is it Erskine J Poetry Prize?
I think so. Yeah,
from Smartish Pace, and you're. First length, full-length poetry book has won the Able Muse Book Award. Not bad to have a first book win a national award. I would say you have a future and a present and a past. Let's hear one more poem from Jenny Keith.
Sure. This is a DC origin story. The city of great white lies assures with charnel smiles. Forefathers monumented, marble maw of lawyer speak, eviction, bullhorn, uprising smoke. People dance in circles here, hold hands around I-495, kick toward an unreachable center. Our story in 1963, one little wagon covered, circled by itself, lonely, a father, mother, unholy child, dodged triumvirates, yellow triangles posted on sturdy buildings' walls. Not in the city, but of it, they rounded the southwest crescent ahead of trouble for a time. House, larger house, their gazes gradually trained outward toward cooling dark, away from flags and subterfuge, among the pines, they invested in small shares of wilderness, rifles trained toward railroad tracks, growing hungry for a memory of natural light, eclipsed in deep sable forest. Patience, a doe's eye.
Whoa, that is a definition of patience, isn't it? A doe's eye. Listen, those of you who are listening to us, you can just put a phrase, and that phrase will be part of a whole thing. You don't have to give the whole line. Just put those fragments together, and we'll get it. We will get it. She teaches us that. Well, you know, since you two are people as well as poets, people like to know, they like to get down with you. So I'm going to ask a few questions, and then we'll see if you know the answers. And so, Jenny and Beth, I'm going to ask both of you some personal stuff. And one thing that I really, really want to know is, what do you want when you're writing a poem? What do you want from that poem? Because, you know, here we have an image, here we have an idea, here we have a feeling, but what are you doing? I mean, why are you doing this, and what are we trying to do? Beth, first.
It's important to me to evoke a feel or emotion from that's available to the reader. I don't write specifically about certain subjects, but I do write about, meaning I don't give a lot of details, but I do want it to resonate with people. I've had people ask, like, well, I think this is about addiction, or I think this is about this. And, you know, that I love that that it evokes, you know, something. And that's the connection we have to the reader. That's very important to me.
Can't get much better than that. What do you think, Jenny? What do you want? You look at all these, you have all these words in your head, and you have all these feelings, and you know how to string a bracelet together. But what do you want when you're done?
I want to make a movie.
I want to make a movie.
Yeah, I do. I absolutely adore film, and got my degree in film. I was a film student, and I love David Lynch and other directors. I want to make a movie.
That's the answer, because you are cinematic. Totally cinematic. Well, you do have a movie. Oh, my gosh. I'm so glad I asked. And I want to also ask you another thing. From both of you, I get a life force on the page. I don't get confection. I don't get the icing on the cake. I think you both go to the well. So why is poetry a life force for all of us? Why? I mean, why do you have to do it, Beth?
I have to do it to stay alive, to be honest with you. Like, reading poetry, looking at art, listening to music since I was a kid is what kept me alive. It keeps me alive still, writing it. And I hope that, you know, if somebody reads something I write and thinks, like, that moves them or changes them or make them feel less alone, then I've accomplished. And that, you know, that's it.
Less alone. What is she saying? All that she's saying is gets on a higher vibration. I hate to get woo-woo, but I also love to get woo-woo, because you're getting into a higher vibration where we are really safe. And that is not a bad thing. And Jenny, what is the life force? I feel it in your work. What's going on?
My religious faith teaches me that I have two jobs on the planet. One is to love, and the other is to make things. I'm a lousy cook. I can't fix a lamp or build a bridge. It's just what I make. So I try to do my best to love as best as I can and make something. And this is just what I make, I guess.
I could add to make and service to others, too.
Which is what that's the love.
Both do that. I know.
That's the love.
And finally, how do you get so near to the blood without bleeding? So that poetry is a beautiful camouflage, but how do you know not what not to say, which is highly intuitive? And the better the poet, the more they trust not to say some things. How do you keep, how do you know how to protect yourself, Beth?
As somebody who has PTSD, I have to be aware of that a lot. And I, because I can easily get triggered writing about something. I wrote something recently that that was about a family member that had me completely devastated for like a week. And I mean, I don't mean to laugh at that, but it's like, oftentimes you're, you know, I'm surprised by what it brings out. And it all serves a purpose in processing, you know, emotion and feeling. And
I'm so glad you admitted that, because every one of us is showing that the context for the wound is the poem. And it's just, how do you keep people from getting not too close to it and not too far away? But if you can put that much of you in a poem, that's what we're going to get. I mean, you can't get more out of a poem than the poet's putting in it. And so, Jenny, how do you protect your feelings with film?
One thing that my friend, the late Joe Harrison, taught me is that when I use, when somebody uses form, you use the word that the poem wants, not the word that I want. I can't trust myself to know what I'm writing about. I'm a big believer in woo. And when I start a poem, I let the poem tell me what I need to say.
Oh,
and that sounds really weird, but that's really it. It's like, if I go in with my agenda, I can't always trust myself to tell the truth because I lie.
Oh.
But the poem will tell the truth.
But Jenny, that doesn't come when you're 10 years old. How does that, that comes from writing and writing and writing, because that's what a real pro is doing, letting the poem develop. And I must say, yours does pretty well without your getting in the way. You don't get in the way of your poems at all. And so everyone, we've been listening to the voices of Beth Doolin and Jenny Keith. And now, without interruption, we're going to have a little poetry reading from each. So we'll start with two poems by Beth. Without interruption, I won't even interrupt you.
Okay. Aftermath. When the hurricane came through, we bolted, a cover excuse to disappear. In his shit brown Toyota Corona station wagon, they don't make them anymore. I shouldn't have let him drive. He was blown out, wide-eyed. I was unsure of what was happening, just pieces of a memory, a paper bag torn open on the sidewalk, boiled potato chip wrappers spread about, the smell of creosote, craving a cigarette, but I quit years before. That's all I remember. No such thing as a clean getaway. I see his ghost wherever I go. Every night I dream I'm dying. And I feel like this next piece is rather long, but
we all have great love and patience.
Okay. this is a true story as well, and I have a lot of these just from traveling and people telling me, disclosing things. Greyhound from Columbia, South Carolina to Baltimore, Maryland. He told her he learned to count cards in Atlantic City. He didn't drink, just coffee. Stayed clear-headed while all the weekenders from the city got shit-faced as the hours passed. His uncle ran games out of the basement of his grandfather's restaurant on the boardwalk. She sat in the window seat, holding a deck of tarot cards, about to lay out a three-card spread on her lap, having suddenly left the boyfriend behind to head home to the funeral of the boyfriend before him. She was looking for answers. She told him about the big-haired Baltimore ladies at the Palmer House down in Utah, how they read your cards from a bicycle deck, long glued-on nails, shuffling and fanning the cards before turning them out over in front of you. She loved the sound of the cards fluttering through their fingertips. He told her how he was escorted out of the Flamingo in Vegas on two separate occasions, so now he's stuck with the smaller places. He said when he really needed cash in a pinch, he would set up downtown on Lower Broadway and perform card tricks. He was talented at making things disappear. Before he got off in Greenville, he leaned in and pulled a card from his shirt pocket. "You might need this," he said, and handed her the Queen of Wands.
I have to look up the Queen of Wands now, but you always have a great story to tell. And now we're going to hear two poems from Jenny Keith.
Thank you so much, Grace. This is called Stunt Double. With the right lighting, at some distance, I could pass for my ideal self, that star in my mind's eye, who was shorter at first, but then later, even taller. Red hair from the root and not the bottle. Her eyes, farther apart than mine, and minus the two round rolls that pad my trochanters. She's bread-knifed thin to be a slice in the water, lithe, attenuated, with a voice like harps, harpoons. She plays the role of a slow terror, shadow-sheathed, catwalking to the bank, Venetian blades layering her face and smoke-ring lips as noir as rain-slicked neon, 3 a.m. She could rake it in, cool as a hacienda highball, rolling in spreadsheets I missed by a mile. They said to me, accept, but don't stop trying. Low-carb cuts to the body's script, manifesting meditation. But motion takes me on. While she stays dry as a bone in the luxury lounge, I sweat and gimp and plummet from backs of horses, helicopters, heights where I can see the lay of the land and fall to taste its precious dust. And this poem is about forgiveness. It's called Solstice. Nothing but taillights for miles, the red pain receding day by day, but still a low throb of grief. My feet are not yet cold. The air blues and cools, a heavy velvet front of cloud descends. This is the end of my waiting, I tell myself day after day. This is the last. Eventually we turn, my mother said. We go back to our bleak houses and make do. A bitterness stiffens our bones. Dignity, a consolation prize from disappointment. She washes ghost dishes at a lost sink. I'm still outside. But lo, an echo of engines murmurs through this morning's still dark air. A gleam of chrome in the moon for a moment, a flank of that dark sedan, and then I know. A blaze of headlamp steers its cones like the hands of a clock, and I see the face. Smiling like a god's at a distance, smiling, thinking twice, returning to me.
I am so inspired. I know that I can, when you hear great art, you know you can do it. That's my mantra. And I have to just remark on that poem because the insert is something that people don't always know to do. And the center of the poem where your mother is back and there's a bitterness and then she washes ghost dishes. That's a little insert in the bigger frame. And that is what gives it the center of the poem. That's so smart. Do you each have one more poem, a final poem to leave our listeners with?
Sure.
I'm really high on this. I am so, what a way to live. Oh, sure. I'm so lucky. What a way to live. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So this, you know, I grew up on a farm. So this is a short poem about the days of the 80s here when there was a lot of drought. Where on the Eastern Shore where I grew up. Drought. 48 days. Cornfields scalding under the hot July sun. She's on the porch waving a church fan, a white handkerchief tucked into her bra. He's killing a black snake to hang over the wire fence of the chicken yard. It's supposed to bring rain. Desperation leads to believing in just about anything.
Well, we finally have a farm poem. I was waiting for that. Yes. And so, Jennifer, a poem.
This is about writing in form and why I do that. It's called Snow Plow, appropriate for Baltimore right now. They love to talk about the naked page as metaphor for staring down the void. Exciting, maybe, to reach the age of 30. One would hope by then you've toyed with images of self as tilting knight of the apocalypse enough. For now, twice past the mark, you have the right to name the task for what it is. To plow an oblong parking lot, knee-deep in snow. The engine and the scrape, the backup beep and rev, the only sound. Row after row, with mounding end stops gathering like sheep. The making is unmaking, leaving just a shallow layer. Salt will do the rest. Sometimes it's powder, or an icy crust makes slower going. Still, you do your best and then go home. Tomorrow, cars can park. Not your concern. You're aching, feeling old. It's good to have a job, despite the dark, despite the loneliness, despite the cold.
I don't know what to say. These poets are right up there. They're really in charge of language, and I'm so proud to be with you both. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Funding is provided by the Sinopithund, the Rivada Foundation, Natalie Canavore, Avide Shoshani, Jung Ki Kim Renault, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.